Hello and welcome to Yesterday's Indianapolis, a podcast about the over 200-year history of the Circle City. My name is Ed Fujawa. I'm a local attorney and historian and writer of the Indianapolis history blog, class900indy.com. I'd like to welcome you to what is the inaugural episode of Yesterday's Indianapolis, because really that is what the world needs more of right now, are more podcasts. But what I'm hoping to do with this podcast is kind of use it as a supplement for the material that I publish on the class900indy.com blog. Now, I started that blog back in 2018 now, almost 7 years ago. And over the course of those 7 years, I've published, I think it's over 160 blog posts about history, the history of not only Indianapolis, but kind of Marion County as a whole and the area surrounding Indianapolis. So there's a lot of content there, if you're interested in Indianapolis history, for you to explore. What I'm hoping to do is that some podcasts will be based upon blog posts that I previously published, might be a recent blog post or maybe one from a few years ago, but basically a companion piece, while other podcasts will be standalone podcasts, a topic that I researched especially for the podcast itself. And then finally, I'm hoping to have some special guests on the podcast, local historians, local archivists, folks who can talk about Indianapolis history topics that they're interested in or projects that they're researching, things along those lines. So you don't always have to listen to me. You can listen to some other folks talk about their interest and what cool things they're doing with Indianapolis history. So again, welcome to the podcast. And today's episode is going to be titled Murder on the Canal, Calvin Fletcher and the Trial of Thomas Finch. So anyone who's followed my blog over the years or any of my social media knows that the Central Canal, which runs through Indianapolis, has been a long time kind of research topic of mine. I'm always looking for new parts of the canal or old parts of the canal that are still existing, digging through its history, things like that. And this is really a kind of a historical true crime related to the canal, as well as Calvin Fletcher. So Calvin Fletcher came to Indianapolis in the fall of 1821, when the city was really still in its infancy, really before it had taken the mantle of the seat of government for the state of Indiana. That actually wouldn't happen until 1825. But Fletcher arrived, again, 1821. He had previously read the law while residing in Urbana, Ohio, starting in 1817. And upon his arrival in Indianapolis, he became one of the first practicing attorneys in the new town. Now, Fletcher came to Indianapolis in 1821, but he was originally born in Ludlow, Vermont in 1798. And then he had moved, once he got older, he had moved into Ohio to kind of find his fortune, and that's when he began studying the law. So recognized as one of the town's prominent early citizens, both because of his early arrival in the city and his professional and civic pursuits, Fletcher was also a constant diarist, maintaining a regular diary from the time he moved from his parents' home in Vermont to his death shortly after the Civil War. Covering some 9 hard copy volumes, the diary is a massive read and provides fascinating insights into the early practice of law in the state, life in frontier Indianapolis, as well as just, Fletcher's own thoughts about current events, things like that. Really provides a revealing look into the mind of a man who, from the outside, he was respected as one of the city's premier attorneys. But on the inside, he harbored significant doubt about his own legal abilities, and as the diary kind of reveals, a lot of anxiety. Fletcher also often wrestled with a disinterest in the practice of law and frequently wrote about his plans to separate himself from the legal profession and focus on his agricultural interests based on his significant land holdings that he had throughout not only Marion County, but around the state. So Fletcher's legal practice was generally centered around civil matters. While criminal cases were not his specialty, that area of the law was not unknown to him, and he had served as prosecuting attorney in Marion County in 1822, and then for the 5th Judicial Circuit in 1825 during the early years of his practice. Most notably, he served as one of several attorneys retained to defend white settlers accused of killing a party of Native Americans along Fall Creek near Pendleton, Indiana in 1824. Now, this incident was later dubbed the Massacre on Fall Creek, and it was one of the early instances of white settlers being tried for crimes against Native Americans. There's actually an excellent book about this incident by David Thomas Murphy. I believe it was published in 2010 by the Indiana Historical Society Press, but it's titled Murder in Their Hearts: The Fall Creek Massacre. I'll drop a link in the show notes for this book, but it's a nice kind of overview and look at the incident, not only the crimes but also the trial that resulted. By the mid-1830s, Fletcher's legal practice was predominantly in the civil arena, including very lucrative collections practice. During his first decade and a half in Indianapolis, Fletcher had risen to be one of the city's most prominent attorneys. Possibly the result of this reputation, he noted in his diary entry for March 23rd, 1837, that he and Hiram Brown, another local attorney, have been retained to represent, quote, several Irishmen, one of whom is indicted for murder by the name of Finch, one for theft with intent to commit murder, end quote. The Indianapolis, Indiana Journal newspaper reported on this crime in its March 25th, 1837 edition, noting, quote, "On Saturday last, a fight of a serious character took place on the line of the Central Canal, 4 or 5 miles north of this place, in which one individual was killed and two others were badly wounded. The combatants were all Irishmen." The Finch referenced by Fletcher was Thomas Finch, one of the many Irish immigrants who had been hired to work on the various internal improvement projects, including roads, railroads, and canals, which were resulting from the Internal Improvement Act of 1836. This legislation had been passed by the Indiana General Assembly and was intended to kind of, Indiana was still in a frontier state at the time and was intended to open up the state for transportation and an outlet for the farm products, manufacturing products, things like that that were made in the state or grown in the state, and allow them an outlet to markets outside of Indiana and the Middle West. So Finch was working on the Indianapolis Division of the Central Canal, and the Central Canal was one of the largest components of this Internal Improvement Act. And it was being, at the time, it was the Indianapolis Division was being constructed from Broad Ripple into downtown Indianapolis and eventually to the bluffs on the White River, south of Indianapolis, near present-day Waverly. Now, the Central Canal was actually planned, if it had ever been finished, it would have been planned to run from somewhere around Peru, Indiana, on the Wabash, all the way down through Anderson, through Noblesville, Indianapolis, down through Martinsville, and eventually to the Ohio River. Unfortunately, the Internal Improvement Act fell apart. The state fell into bankruptcy or near bankruptcy in 1839, and the canal was never completely finished. Although the Wabash and Erie Canal, which was completed down to Evansville, kind of runs along the same route of the Central Canal. The Indianapolis, Indiana Journal noted that the victim of aforementioned murder was a man named Sheridan, who was a contractor on the canal. The journal further reported that, quote, "The persons charged with the killing and outrage were immediately arrested, and as our court is now in session, it is presumed that the affair will shortly assume the form of an indictment." So Sheridan was one half of the partnership of Devine and Sheridan, who held a contract for Section 6 of the Indianapolis Division of the Central Canal. This section would have been in the stretch of the canal, like around Butler University, but north of where the canal crosses Fall Creek. So kind of in that area from Butler south. Not exactly sure the specific spot. The sections kind of varied in length, but that is the general area where this incident would have taken place. So the indictment cited by Fletcher and the journal was in fact forthcoming and was filed in Marion County Circuit Court on March 25th, 1837. I obtained a copy of this indictment, as well as other court documents, from the Indiana State Archives. The indictment provided additional detail about the alleged crime, although I will warn you, I'm going to read some quotes. The language in the indictment is quite, I guess I should say, old-fashioned, maybe a little flowery. So bear with me as I read this. But per the indictment, quote, "That Thomas Finch, late of said county of Marion, laborer, not having the fear of God before his eyes, but being moved and seduced by the instigation of the devil, on the 17th day of March, in the year of our Lord, 1837, with force and arms, at the county aforesaid, in and upon one Michael Sheridan, a reasonable creature, in living in peace of God, and the said state of Indiana, then and there, feloniously, willfully, unlawfully, and of his malice aforethought, did make an assault," end quote. So as I said, the language is a little flowery. It makes it even more difficult that there's not very much punctuation in there. So you kind of have to read into it where there might be a comma or even a period. But this assault on Sheridan by Finch, Finch apparently used a wooden club as his weapon, which Again, the indictment describes the club in great detail, and it notes that the club was, quote, length of 3 feet and the thickness of 3 inches and the width of 3 inches. So the indictment continues describing the assault, noting that Finch struck, quote, Michael Sheridan in and upon the left side of the head near the base of the skull, end quote. So Sheridan suffered a fatal wound and died the following day, March 18th, 1837. Fletcher's diary is silent as to the remaining defendants referenced in his diary entry from March 23rd, 1837, and his focus was centered squarely on Thomas Finch. This case apparently caught the attention of a local Catholic priest who, as described by Fletcher, called on him at his home, quote, to inquire about the aid necessary for a Catholic in jail for murder, parentheses, Finch, end quote. Fletcher seems to have taken pity on Finch and described him as being of, quote, common grade, end quote, but with, quote, great vivacity and apparent good intention and indeed with a good character, end quote. Despite Fletcher's prior experience with criminal matters and his time riding the circuit upon arriving in Indianapolis in the 1820s, his diary entries related to Finch's case and the impending trial are replete with internal self-doubt about his skill and his ability to represent his client. He noted at one point that, quote, I feel the great responsibility that rests upon me in this case. Although associated with a partner capable in the law, that's Hiram Brown again, yet I feel and know of the two I'm looked upon as a senior, end quote. Realizing his possible deficiencies in criminal law, Fletcher's trial preparation included consulting what today would likely be described as hornbooks or practice guides. These are basically treatises that attorneys would use to get kind of an overview of an area of the law, kind of a reference book in a way. His diary on July 11, 1837 states, quote, I have this day been examining Roscoe's evidence on criminal cause, end quote, a reference to a treatise that was published in 1836 titled A Digest of the Law of Evidence in Criminal Causes. That same day, Fletcher lamented that, quote, I have not advanced as far in the examination of criminal causes as I expected. I fear I shall not be well prepared, end quote. Fletcher's trial preparation continued with a diary entry from July 12th describing his review of an additional treatise and he and his co-counsel's investigation into the case, as well as his thoughts on the weather for this day. Because in his diary, the weather is a constant subject. He's constantly making observations. So, of course, while he's investigating a case, he's going to toss in an observation about the weather. But going back to Fletcher's diary, he said, quote, I've been examining Russell on crimes in reference to the case of Thomas Finch. Went with H. Brown Esquire to examine the ground where Finch killed Sheridan. Very warm, end quote. Footnotes contained in the Fletcher diary indicate that the source being examined by Fletcher was called A Treatise on Crimes and Misdemeanors by William Oldknoll Russell, a British barrister who first published the work in 1819. Apparently, an American version was published in 1824, and then several updated versions were released in the United States over the next 20 years. And I actually found some that were dated all the way into the 1890s. So it was kind of a long-running treatise. Unfortunately, no additional details provided regarding Fletcher and Brown's visit to the scene of the crime, aside from Fletcher's nonchalant observance of the temperature of that day. Fletcher continued his trial preparation, including a notation on July 16, 1837, that he was feeling, quote, much disturbed, end quote, regarding the prospect of the upcoming trial of Thomas Finch. On July 18th, the day before the trial was to commence, Fletcher's diary finally provides some additional details from the case. Quote, engaged in court, and my mind, as much if not more than usual, engaged in the subject of the expected trial of Thomas Finch, a young Irishman who is charged with killing one Michael Sheridan in a riot at one Penderville's shanty on the canal, about 5 miles from town, on St. Patrick's Day last, March 17th last, in parentheses, end quote. So the Pendervilles referenced by Fletcher was Edward Penderville, not plural, but just Penderville, who was a contractor for Section 5 of the Indianapolis Division of the Central Canal, which was adjacent to the section being worked on by Devine and Sheridan, which was, again, Section 6. So Devine and Sheridan were at Section 6. They were a little downstream from Penderville's section. Penderville was farther north and closer to Broad Ripple. So the incident which resulted in Sheridan's death was known as a Irish fight, which was a relatively common event on the various internal improvement projects being constructed around Indiana in the late 1830s. With all these projects going on, most of the workers were Irish immigrants who had traveled west in the United States following various construction projects as the states were, not only Pennsylvania, Ohio, and then Indiana, as the states were doing these internal improvements, these Irish immigrants moved westward to find work on the projects. Generally, there were two groups of Irish workers, the Far Downs and the Corconians. Both groups were predominantly Catholic, but harbored ill will towards each other and competed for work along the canal lines and other project sites. So the Far Downs came from the more northern portions of Ireland, while the Corconians came from the County Cork, which was a large county in southwest Ireland. So this fight that resulted in Sheridan's death was one of those Irish fights. The original report in the Indianapolis, Indiana Journal from March 25th does provide a little bit of information about this Irish fight. Quote, "The party sustaining the principal injury is said to belong to what is termed the Far Downs, and not to have been more than three in number, while the other party consisted of Corconians and something like double that number. The individual who became the victim of their brutal violence was a contractor, we understand, by the name of Sheridan." So there were other Irish fights around Indiana, besides just on the Central Canal, but also along the Wabash and Erie Canal and in various other locations, including on some of the railroad projects. But continuing with the case, jury selection for the state of Indiana versus Thomas Finch took place on July 19th, 1837. Fletcher identified three members of the jury, specifically identifying them as John Williams, Hervey Bates, and a Colonel Johnson, and observed that of the three, Williams and Bates were, quote, first old citizens, end quote, of Indianapolis, and that, quote, all three respectable, intelligent men of the first order with good practical sense, end quote. Bates, in particular, was an old citizen and had come to Indianapolis in 1822 and had been the first sheriff of Marion County. The reference to John Williams might be an error by Fletcher or perhaps the editors of his diary. Fletcher may have meant John Wilkins, a local entrepreneur who, as will be discussed later, is subsequently identified as a member of the Finch jury. Fletcher does not note if there were any additional members of the Finch jury. So on the side of the state, William Quarles was the prosecutor, while William Wick was the presiding judge. Wick was a very prominent jurist at the time, not only in Indianapolis, but in the state as a whole, and he'd served in various elected positions at the state and national level and multiple times as a judge. And he'd actually presided as a judge over the 1824 trial following the massacre on Fall Creek, which was discussed earlier. Fletcher and Hiram Brown represented the defendants. While Fletcher was representing Finch, his diary and court records do not reveal whether there were other attorneys representing the other defendants or even who Hiram Brown was representing. It does not seem that he was actually representing Finch. He may have been representing one of the other defendants. Fletcher also references Ovid Butler in his diary, who was his law partner and the founder of today's Butler University. Apparently, he assisted in the summation portion of the case on behalf of the defendants. But the extent of his involvement is not clear, and the court records do not provide any additional information on his participation. Whether opening statements occurred is not noted in Fletcher's diary, nor are the arguments noted in the available case records contained in the Indiana State Archives. Fletcher's diary only documents that one or two witnesses were examined the same day as jury selection, but those individuals were not identified. The next day, July 20th, 1837, featured additional testimony, and on Friday, July 21, the defense rested its case. Fletcher addressed the jury for a closing statement, although his diary again reveals his inner anxiety. He noted that, quote, "As usual, I was but poorly prepared. Here I would remark that the best efforts I have usually made have been made upon reflection and study, and much regret that other pursuits have deprived me of the necessary time to improve myself in the forensic addresses," end quote. In spite of his claimed shortcomings in criminal law and the forensic addresses, Fletcher presented a 3.5-hour-long closing argument on the morning of Saturday, July 22nd, 1837. Fletcher detailed that, quote, "In my remarks, I succeeded nearer what I would wish and have always been ambitious to obtain than I ever did before to my recollection," end quote. He concluded his closing at about 12:30 p.m. His co-counsel, Hiram Brown, also presented a closing argument, which went on for another 2 or 3 hours, followed by William Quarles for the state. Unfortunately, a record of the closing statements presented by counsel has not been located in either the state archives or the Fletcher papers. However, from Fletcher's diary, it appears his strategy was to frame the alleged crime as manslaughter, where Finch killed his adversary in defense of himself and his boss, Edward Penderville. In describing his closing statement, Fletcher noted that, quote, "In this case, I had for my client a young Irishman of good countenance, a warm heart, who, from his friendship of his employer, while he apprehended great danger, killed a man who was not at the time offending him, but from who the prisoner apprehended great bodily harm, end quote. So what it sounds like there was that he was at least putting in terms of Finch was trying to defend Pinderville from an attack by Sheridan, which resulted in the death of Sheridan. Fletcher's diary provides that the court adjourned not long after the closing arguments and then reconvened after nightfall, at which time Judge Wick, quote, delivered a splendid charge, but not calculated to aid the jury much in coming to any definite conclusions, end quote. So that's probably a reference to jury instructions, which apparently Fletcher was not terribly impressed with. So Fletcher returned home while the jury was deliberating and had fallen asleep when the jury returned with a verdict around midnight. He was awakened by his wife and returned to the courthouse. Fletcher noted that he had represented Finch, quote, almost without fee or reward, end quote, and that during the trial, quote, I took in that time no kind of stimulant whatever and ate very sparingly. I arrived stimulated on an occasion of the kind, made a failure, I believe, in consequence. So what he's saying there is he was basically, it sounds like he was just stressed out for those days of the trial, and he wasn't really eating or drinking much over the course of those few days. And the failure he references was that Thomas Finch was found guilty of manslaughter, although he avoided the more serious murder charge contained in the original indictment. The available Marion County court records for this matter contain a brief verdict document noting that the jury found that Thomas Finch did unlawfully, quote, kill and slay Michael Sheridan, end quote. The jury sentenced Finch to 5 years imprisonment and fined him $100. Aside from the initial coverage of the fight and murder on March 25th in the Journal, no reference to the trial has been found in the various local newspapers which were publishing at the time. For Fletcher, the trial had been exhausting. The day after the verdict was rendered, a Sunday, Fletcher noted in his diary that, quote, I never have been much more fatigued and worn out, end quote. For an entry for the following day, July 25th, 1837, Fletcher wrote that, quote, I felt very little like doing much. I felt no disposition to tend to business. Indeed, had I been highly stimulated for the last 4 days, I could not have felt worse, end quote. And Fletcher was the type of guy who was always out doing some sort of work, whether it was doing something on his farm, his legal practice, later on it would be banking, other business interests. So for him to not want to get up and do business, he was pretty exhausted at the time. So following the trial, Fletcher continued his legal practice and partnership with Ovid Butler. In addition to Butler and Fletcher, their small firm would also add attorney Simon Yendez, himself a member of a very prominent early Indianapolis family, to the firm in July of 1839. Some years later, Yendez would write about his recollections of Fletcher as an attorney. While no mention of the Finch trial is made by Yendez, he notes that Fletcher would, quote, investigate a case to the buttons, end quote, and was, quote, specially strong in cross-examining witnesses, end quote. However, despite his skills, Fletcher's diary continues to reveal a desire to move beyond the law and pursue agricultural endeavors via his extensive land holdings in and around Marion County. By the mid-1840s, Yendez had left their small firm, and Fletcher and Butler were dissolving their partnership and the process of winding down their practice. While Butler would continue to practice law for a few more years, Fletcher's primary business interests would eventually turn towards banking and farming with an occasional dabbling in legal matters. As for Finch, no further mention is made of him or the trial in Fletcher's diary. State prison records note Finch as an inmate at the state penitentiary in Jefferson, Indiana, down on the Ohio River. Interestingly, it appears that he may have attempted an escape in 1839, although there's a note on the prison census that might have been associated with the inmate underneath, listed underneath Finch. It's not terribly clear. But Finch remained in Jeffersonville until 1840, after which time his name disappears from the prison census. Records in the Indiana State Archives reveal that Finch was actually pardoned on May 15, 1840 by Governor David Wallace and released. The records at the State Archives include a petition, actually multiple petitions, in favor of a pardon or reprieve, which was submitted by members of the jury who heard the case and a group of Marion County officials. The jury letter was signed by several individuals beyond just three members of the jury identified by Fletcher during the trial, and this is where the whole Wilkins and Williams issue pops up again. The jury letter included a signature from a John Wilkins, which, referencing back to Fletcher identifying the members of the jury, the reference of a John Williams might have been an error by Fletcher, or perhaps a transcription error when his handwritten diary was transcribed into print. But it's unclear whether the signatories included maybe members of the grand jury who issued the original indictment, in addition to trial court members. It's just not clear. The other letter was signed by Prosecutor William Quarles, Adam Wright, who was a Marion County judge, and R.B. Duncan, who is the longtime clerk of the Marion County Circuit Court, along with another signatory was the sheriff of Marion County. The letters from both groups were addressed to His Excellency David Wallace and are very similar in content and phrasing. The writing appears to be the same in both letters, save the signatures, although there's no indication in either of the letters or local media, local newspapers, who is leading the efforts to free Finch. Aside from these two letters, there was also a petition that was signed by a few dozen citizens of Marion County advocating for Finch's release. Near the top of this list was Thomas A. Morris, the former chief engineer of the Central Canal, who would later go on to become a Civil War general and later a railroad magnate. Once he post-Civil War, he became heavily involved in various railroad lines and became very influential in that area. Interestingly, Fletcher's signature does not appear in these pardon documents. Census records from Southwest Ohio in 1850 and 1860 note a Thomas Finch of Irish background and a similar age working as a laborer slash farmhand in that state. Now, the age of Finch is never really identified in Fletcher's diary, but in the pardon documents, the various letters make reference to Finch being about 19 years old. And the 1850 and 1860 census records, the 1850 notes that this Thomas Finch is 33 years old, and in 1860 note that he is 43 years old. So if we're looking at him being released, you know, if he's 19 years old, he was in jail for, or he's in prison for 3 years, he's roughly 22, 23 years old, somewhere in that area, in 1840 when he's released. In 1850, would have been 33 years old. So, you know, there's some inconsistency in Finch's age. But that's not really unusual with census records, considering the proximity Southwest Ohio is, you know, the proximity of this area in Southwest Ohio to Jeffersonville, which is just a little bit down. Jeffersonville is just a little bit downstream on the Ohio River. I think it is possible that this is the same Thomas Finch. Of course, Thomas Finch is also a rather common name, so we cannot say for sure. But that is the story of Calvin Fletcher and the trial of Thomas Finch. There is going to be a companion blog post to this podcast. A link will be put into the show notes, but I encourage you to take a look at that blog. A lot of the, you know, you'll recognize a lot of the text in the blog post, but there are a lot of pictures and images of some of the documents I've referenced, so you can take a look at them yourself. There'll also be an opportunity to look at a full copy of the indictment. This word warning. The writing is rather difficult to read, but if you want to take a shot at it, you certainly can. So I encourage you to go to class900indy.com and check out the companion blog post, which will also contain the various sources used for the blog post as well as the podcast. I do want to give a special thanks to the Indiana State Archives and the staff there. They were very, very helpful in pulling the not only the indictment documents, the trial court documents, but also the pardon documents. I originally pulled the trial documents back in 2018, and as I was preparing for this blog post and podcast, I realized I'd actually accidentally deleted that email and the trial documents. So they were very kind to send those to me again. But their assistance was much appreciated. It's fantastic that we have an institution like that that keeps court records like this, so we can kind of go back and explore how the law was being practiced back in the 1830s. And it was a fascinating research project for me. So again, thank you for listening to the inaugural podcast for yesterday's Indianapolis, and keep an eye out on class900indy.com for new blog posts. And you know, I'm hoping to do maybe one or two podcasts per month. We'll see how it shakes out, because I'm trying to, you know, additionally put out content on the blog. So in addition to, of course, my day job, everything I'm doing on the podcast and the blog is in my spare time. So we'll see how that shakes out. But thank you very much for listening.